half of the country is going to lose their job. We're in the most labor-constrained market on earth. And this idea that half the people are going to lose their job because they don't feel comfortable a vaccine is not something that's going to work in a constrained labor market. So what you're going to start to see is a lot of pushback. So the advice is, everybody is uncomfortable, fill out full medical and religious exemptions. You say, what's my medical exemption? Your medical exemption is that there's 23,000 permanently disabled people here, and our government won't tell us who is. 50,000 have died. Our government tell us, how do you know you're not going to end up in one of the red boxes? You say, listen, sorry. You know, one of the questions on the form is usually a pretty crazy question. It says, have you ever had a fatal reaction to the COVID-19 vaccine? It's like, how do you answer that? You're still alive, right? And you haven't taken the vaccine. But the correct thing to do is check the box. Yes, that's the reason why I don't want to take it. Yes. I mean, it makes sense. I'm not taking it because I don't want to die. It's not like you're not a troublemaker. You told me you worked in your job forever. You did a great job. You said, listen, I don't want to take the vaccine because I don't want to die. That's your medical exemption. It's that simple. The second thing is religious exemption. Almost everybody's religion of different denominations says, your body is a temple, and you are not going to allow something in your body that you know is going to hurt your body. Okay? And just because half the country took it, and the people who took it got through it okay and they didn't have a problem, it doesn't mean it's okay that the next person's going to die. This is very important. It's, you know, there's all kinds of fables out there, the lost sheep and what have you. We don't behave this way in our country. Just because the majority of people took it and they're okay, it doesn't mean it's okay people to die. There were people in my circles about my age. One day they came over to my house. You know, they had just biked over. They're probably about 60, and they proudly announced they took the vaccine. You know, here I was, you know, working on my research, and it was about March time frame. And I said, gosh, you took the vaccine. Well, yes, we took the vaccine. We want to be free and travel. I said, well, I'm kind of concerned. I said, we had 1,200 deaths at that time. We got about 1,200 deaths. He goes, what are you talking about? 1,200 deaths? He goes, 60 million people vaccinated? 1,200 deaths? He goes, small price to pay. And you know what, in my mind, you know how I finished that sentence? Small price to pay for the Aryan race. That is exactly what was said at the beginning of the eugenics program in early Nazi Germany. It's like, listen, I did okay, this guy died, I don't care. It's about me. No, that's not how we behave in America. And that's the mindset now with people. You know, the courts have had mandated vaccine programs, mandated mask programs. Do you think a judge or people in the court system is going to care about your rights that you don't want the vaccine? No. So the point is, full medical religious exemptions, when denied, then you dispute. And if you need help, there's all kinds of help out there. Liberty Counsel is one. There's many others. I'll tell you one other anecdote because I know you're waiting. There's a pharmacist who has been texting me from Kaiser Permanente. He doesn't want to take the vaccine. He's a young guy. So he fills out his medical and religious exemptions on the form to Kaiser Permanente. Gets submitted. 10 minutes later, it comes back from the exemption office and says, we regret to inform you that your exemptions have been declined. And then he emails back. He goes, well, is this the same office that I submit my letter of intent to sue for harassment and lack of due process? And then 10 minutes later, email comes back. We're happy to accept your exemptions. So the point is, this is about, the first person said this is about control. He's right. This is a game of chicken. This is people, somehow it's in the minds of others to say, listen, how big and strong are you? How strong is your backbone? What I'm saying is, let's show it. Let's see it. This is the time for some real American backbone. And you know, as uncomfortable as you feel pressed and cornered and squeezed, that type of force of your will and your rationale and your compassion should be force you to put others in their place on this issue. No one, under any circumstance, can put any pressure on you or coerce you or make you feel uncomfortable or threaten reprisal or threaten their job. And you have to make them pay. And I think everybody's at the point where we need to, in a sense, take charge of what's going on. I'm not going to use this right now. I mean, if it's a reminder. I think I've got a mask in my pocket. I won't use that either. The first point I want to make is for new products, we demand safety, safety, safety. And I want to let you know about this. I have been the chairman of data safety monitoring boards for Big Pharma and for the National Institutes of Health and many other stakeholders. So I have a very good name in Washington with the FDA. We always demand safety. So any product that comes from a pharmacy, by the time you get that product, it has been safety tested exhaustively to make sure it's safe. The majority of people in this room take some medicine. I know I do. You know, everybody, but virtually all people, as they get through life, in order to make it to ripe old age, need some medicinal help. So we rely on product safety. There are safety inspections done on the roof over your head right now. There are safety inspections done on almost everything we have in our public life. And I can tell you, with a new vaccine, our expectations are no different. And the minimum standard that America deserves on a vaccine in terms of safety reports to us is at least monthly, if not weekly. If we're going to ask the whole country to take a vaccine, at least monthly. And as we sit here today, it's October. The vaccine started in December. Our government and the government stakeholders are the NIH, the CDC, and the FDA have given us no safety report. None. Zero. It is, that observation alone is alarming. We had prior pandemics. So swine flu pandemic, 1976. We had 220 million people in the United States. There was a vaccine. And there was a hope that we could actually get out of the swine flu pandemic with the vaccine. We vaccinated 55 million Americans in the Ford administration era. And we got to 25 deaths after the vaccine. And people started to get uncomfortable. And it was the newspapers were filled with stories. Well, people have died, but we're not sure if it's the vaccine or not. And there were over 500 cases of what's called Guillain-Barré syndrome, or GBS. Guillain-Barré syndrome is an ascending paralysis that can happen. And it's kind of an oddball thing when the immune system gets activated in an unusual way after a vaccine. But it is terrifying for those who got Guillain-Barré syndrome. And they got to about 500 cases, and the thought was, it's not safe. We can't go on and do the whole country with 25 deaths and 500 cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome. And they shut it down. It turned out it went up to about 43 deaths. That's about the same tolerance today for a drug. If a new drug got on the market and there were five unexplained deaths, it would get a black box warning. It would say, warning, this drug may cause death. At 50 deaths, I guarantee the FDA pulls products off the market and there's some type of study to figure out what went wrong. Sometimes the drugs are contaminated. Many of you are aware when Tylenol got contaminated. Remember that? It got pulled off the shelf. And if you see an ad on TV, it'll say, you'll see the ad and what the drug said, but then there'll be some warning. It's called fair balance. So we actually have a U.S. Cosmetic Drug Act truth in advertising law that says when a product is put forward, there must be fair balance. You must hear about the benefits, but also the risks. That's just fair. So I'm going to follow this outline, make a few comments with respect to each of these bullets. I'm like I've been a professor of medicine of several medical schools, so I have to. This is like a medical school lecture. So, okay. As mentioned, last year I was invited to give commentary in The Hill. This is a print journal, an internet journal, in Washington, largely for lawmakers and insiders on this. And so as a trained epidemiologist, that means I kind of study these types of things. In many ways, I was born for this. I had previously testified in Washington on a product label expansion in 2007. I had been on C-SPAN for a considerable period of time. I was in one of the advisory groups in President Clinton's advisory panel to healthcare many years ago, 1997. And so I was no stranger to Washington. I was no stranger to public life. But this, when COVID-19 crisis hit, it almost seemed like there was a vacuum of doctors who are actually stepping up and showing leadership in the United States. Doctors in practice seem to retract, and almost as if COVID-19 was somebody else's problem and they didn't want to get involved. So about mid-year, once it became known that COVID-19 was going to be amenable to a vaccine, all we heard about was the vaccine. And naturally, there was great excitement. And this started about April, May of last year. But around the summertime, I published this paper expressing my concern. Because my concern was this, in a sense, gamble that was happening. That, you know, if you invest in something, if you put everything in bonds, it would be kind of a gamble. If you put everything in technology or stocks, it would be a gamble. You want a balanced approach. I was saying, you know, our approach ought to be split among efforts to reduce the spread of the illness, treating people early to make sure they're not injured by the virus, doing the best we can in the hospital, and then vaccine. But not everything on vaccine. I got a sense that it was just going to be imbalanced. And as you know, a vaccine isn't treatment. And so if we're going to wait for a vaccine, that's going to be a lot of people who are getting sick with nothing to offer them. So let's go through the vaccines. Now, I anticipate here that probably half of you have taken the vaccine. About half of my family took the vaccine because, in a sense, Americans were asked to do this. This was a public offering. And what you need to know is on the right side of the slide is the technology or the biologic technology for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And this is similar to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine overseas. This is called an adenoviral vector. So there's a way to, in a sense, use an existing virus, load it with the gene of interest, and have that virus come into the body. As long as the virus can't replicate, the virus will be almost like a mosquito. You see how it looks like a mosquito? It literally it sits on the surface and injects the DNA into the cell. The body then takes up that DNA and makes messenger RNA from it, and then makes the protein target. On the left-hand side of the screen is Pfizer and Moderna. Actually, that would be on your right-hand side. I'm sorry. So on your right-hand side is RNA. That's Pfizer and Moderna. And that's different. That's actually a direct injection of messenger RNA, but it's synthetic messenger RNA that has some strong, what's called nucleoside caps on the end. And the nucleoside caps keep that messenger RNA from being degraded, so it can be used over and over again. Normal messenger RNA that's made, and your bodies right now are all making messenger RNA to make all the proteins that are regulating your body right now. Your body's a protein factory. Messenger RNA is always one use. So you use it once, and the body dissolves it. Then you make a new one, and the body dissolves it. So cellular biochemistry is really amazing to study what your cells are doing right now. So these are novel technologies, and they've actually never been used before for vaccines. With the messenger RNA technology, there's only one drug that we can use. As a cardiologist, I can prescribe it. It's called patirisan, and it is a form of a messenger RNA drug, and we can give it to have it try to interfere with the production of another gene that codes for what's called transthyretin or prealbumin in a condition called amyloidosis. So that's probably a lot of heavy medicine terms for you. But there is such a technology. These have never been redirected to have the body manage them like a vaccine. So the concept was, through either one of these mechanisms, we're going to have the cells produce the spike protein. The spike protein are the little red Ys that you see up there. The spike protein is the same spike protein on the ball of the virus. So the ball of the virus is the nucleocapsid, and the spikes are the spike protein, the little spicules. Well, these vaccines trick our body's cellular machinery into making the spike protein. The spike protein, as shown, goes up onto the cell surface, where the body will recognize it as being foreign, so it's going to be natural, the body's going to attack it. And then our antigen-presenting cells, like that big octopus up there, will try to present it to T cells and B cells, so they'll start to make antibodies. But what was learned on the vaccines, and I think this became an evolved knowledge from the time they were released, it was learned that the vaccines actually cause the body to make a lot of spike protein, and it circulates. So it not only is expressed on cell surfaces, but it circulates in the human body. And I think that was an unexpected finding. So a paper by Ogata and colleagues from Harvard showed that it circulates in measurable concentration at least for 2 weeks, and then after the second injection, it tends to dampen down with the antibody production. But the spike protein, it was learned later on, that's actually the lethal part of COVID-19. The lethal part of the virus is not the ball, it's actually the spikes. And the spikes themselves damage organs. They damage red blood cells, they damage blood vessels, they cause blood clotting. All of this has been shown in very solid papers since the release of the vaccines. Okay? It was the hope that the vaccines would cause a little local production of spike protein in the arm. You'd form an immunity to it, and you're good. And I think the majority of people who took the vaccine, that's exactly what happened. Now, we've had half of America take the vaccine. They had a sore arm for a few days, and they're fine. But the theory is some people probably take up a lot of the vaccine material. They're in lipid nanoparticles. They do circulate all through the body, including the brain, the heart, the other vital organs, they distribute to the ovaries in women, testicles in men. And that spike protein is made in these delicate organs. You can see those little red characters up there. That's going to cause a lot of inflammation and damage in those organs. And it makes sense. This is not like a tetanus shot. You get a tetanus shot, it's a lump of tetanus protein that stays in your arm. You form immunity, that's it. The tetanus shot does not go to your brain or all over the place. Same thing with a flu shot. You get a flu shot. I just had a flu shot 2 weeks ago. It's an inactivated virus. It just sits in your arm. Your body forms immunity. This is different because this is designed to invade your cells. So the vaccine does invade the cells of the human body. So in May, we started to get concerned about this because all of this was learned since release of the vaccines. And people were keeping track of this. And Dr. Bruno in South America, I'm in the author block, started gathering intellectuals all over the academic world and put together this paper that said, listen, we've got serious questions over safety. And as highlighted here, the vaccine programs had no data safety monitoring boards. They had no human ethic boards. They had no critical evidence. They didn't have the external monitoring structures to make sure the programs were safe because the sponsors of the program were the CDC and FDA, so they can't be fair stewards of safety. So usually the FDA is external and the pharmaceutical company is the sponsor. But in this case, the CDC and FDA took that role and there were no external oversight committees. That's the reason why we haven't had any safety report, because there hasn't been any safety mechanisms in the public program. These mechanisms existed in the clinical trials development, but not with the public program. So our points were that these vaccines we now know in May have a dangerous mechanism of action. This spike protein in organs circulating in the bloodstream, causing blood clotting, we know that can't be good. We knew other things that worried us. There were no genotoxicity, teratogenicity, or oncogenicity studies, meaning that we had a situation that standard tests that were done for drugs were skipped. Now, I'm not saying that they're done for vaccines, but normally a vaccine development program has 2 years of observation. That was the FDA guidance. That got truncated to 2 months with Operation Warp Speed. So this gamble that went on to say, listen, if something could happen after the vaccines in the clinical trials, we have too short of a period of time to find that out. There was a concerning ovarian biodistribution study, and this was done by Pfizer. So the Japanese applied for vaccine approval by Pfizer, and the Japanese, and this was in March or so, the Japanese said, wait a minute, show us where these vaccines go in the body. And they made Pfizer do a study in animals to show where the lipid nanoparticles went, and they did hyperconcentrate in the ovaries of female animals. And that was clearly shown through a Freedom of Information Act request from Canada that went to Japan. So that came out. Moderna, by the European Medical Association, submitted they were asked to submit a fertility study in animals. Was the fertility in animals reduced by the vaccines? And the answer was yes. Now, it was not great enough to kill the program, but it's still concerning. Now, there were no safety committees, as I've mentioned. There were no restrictions on properly excluded groups. In the clinical trials program that got the products to the point of public use, they excluded people with COVID recovery, that who had already had COVID. Suspected COVID recovery, people with positive antibodies, they were excluded. Pregnant women, women with childbearing potential who could not guarantee contraception. Why? Excluded groups are always excluded for a reason, two reasons. No opportunity for benefit or great concern for harm. And it was appropriate to exclude those groups in the randomized trials. And as a rule in medicine, if people were excluded from the clinical trials, we never go try that on the population. Never. In fact, it's so strict. If this was an insurance company and they were paying for it, they'd say rejected, denied. It was not in the clinical trials. We're not going to approve it. So that was concerning. We saw pregnant women taking the vaccine. We're like, wait a minute. They were excluded from the clinical trials. How can that be? And there was no effort that we've seen at any point in time to figure out who is potentially being harmed with the vaccine and how can we minimize that harm? How could we make the program safer? Was there something about the injection technique? Was there something about how the products were stored or refrigerated? Was there something about which people came forward for a vaccine? What Americans heard was just, come on, get the shot. Get a needle in every arm. Come on, do it for your country. And these safety concerns were basically just brushed aside. And so it made us very concerned that we never saw this report card. We always have a report card about periodically that tells us. And if you read the consent form of the vaccine, I know a lot of you took it, it says right there, go to VAERS, go to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, and you look at the safety data yourself. I'm a doctor. We were getting these notices. Go to the CDC website and do your own review of safety, because this is emergency use authorization. So I'm going to show you a lot of data from VAERS. By January 22nd, we had already hit in the program, this is what's called the red box report, we already hit 182 deaths up in the upper left. Now, with all the vaccines combined, there are some deaths that are occurring. We get about 278 million shots per year in the United States, 70 different vaccines, all the kids getting vaccines. I've had all my vaccines. I went to India a couple times. I got more vaccines. So, you know, we all take vaccines. And there are some deaths reported, but they're not usually linked to the vaccine. They get reported into the safety system by the people who are basically giving the vaccines. But we're already at 182 in January 22nd. And that was only with 27 million people vaccinated. And if there was a proper data safety monitoring board, a proper safety oversight panel, I am telling you, I do this work for my academic activity, the program would have been shut down in February as being at least unsafe initially so they could figure out who has died after the COVID-19 vaccine. Researchers became incredibly frustrated over the spring. And this paper is from data from April and by Jessica Rose, who's an epidemiologist and a virologist, who the public data is, the VAERS data is publicly available. The CDC data is publicly available. You can download and analyze it, and that's what she did. That giant spike, that giant bar that's up there, that's COVID-19 vaccines. All the small ones are the other years before COVID-19. So the VAERS system is supposed to be an early warning system. It's supposed to warn us that we have a problem so we can stop and make some adjustments. Jessica Rose in this paper is saying, listen, warning, warning, warning. We have an early warning system and we're not paying attention to this. It's like a warning light is going on in some type of control system and we're not paying attention to the early warning system. Now we fast forward to today and you can see what we're looking at on this red box report. These are what's called permanent VAERS numbers. So the CDC has reviewed these and they have assured America that these events have happened. In my practice, I've submitted roughly six of these. And every time the CDC verifies that they've happened, and I'm have to walk you through this. This is shocking. 15,937 Americans have died after the vaccine. 15,000 Americans. 15,900. This is astronomical. We never have this happen with modern day drug pharmacovigilance. Over 200,000 hospitalized or going to urgent care visits. We have 20,789 Americans that are permanently disabled, that the CDC is telling us are permanently disabled from the vaccine. We have 6,812 cases of myocarditis or inflammation of the heart, primarily in young children. The FDA has warnings on this. By the way, the FDA has warnings. Warning, Pfizer, Moderna can cause myocarditis. Warning, Johnson & Johnson can cause blood clots in the brain and cause paralysis. So the FDA is warning us. But at the same time, Americans are being told, take the vaccine. And so people are taking the vaccine, and these what's called red box numbers are skyrocketing. And here is the temporal association on the bottom between taking the shot and when they happen. And then there's the big spike in events. These are alarming numbers. This is what's got America on edge. What happened is people started getting wind of this in April or May. April 8th was the peak of vaccination in the United States, and it trailed off because people started talking. People started talking and say, listen, we don't like it. They're not talking about this on TV, but this doesn't look good. There was this summer, there was an internet survey, unofficial, on Twitter, but it asked the question, do you know somebody or somebody who knows somebody in your circles who's died after the vaccine? 12% of Americans said yes. That's enough to get people on edge. Everybody became very edgy about the vaccine. Even people who took the vaccine and did fine, they started to think, geez, I got through it. Boy, I was lucky. Well, what if I have to come up for a booster? People started thinking about this. Well, more analyses came through, and the relationship in time to death is very tightly associated with the vaccine. 50% of the deaths occur within 48 hours of the shot, and 80% occur within a week. It's not scattered over time. This is very temporally related to the vaccine, including some deaths that occur right in the vaccine center. And so independent analysis came forward. I showed you one from Jessica Rose, the first one, and then one from McLachlan in London. And McLachlan actually analyzed the vignettes, the clinical descriptions of what happened with death. And McLachlan concluded that 86% of the time, there was no other explanation for the death. It looked like the vaccine was the proximate cause. You can never know because you're not right there. And without autopsies or other forms of data, we're reliant on what's in the system. But McLachlan showed that the deaths seemed to be occurring in the very people we wanted to protect, the seniors. So deaths started piling up in the seniors. They piled up in senior homes, in the elderly. It was strongly related to death. It was strongly related to age and the risk of death. Almost as if the spike protein itself, which is the lethal part of the virus, because COVID-19 is deadly in the elderly, it's like the vaccine was for some unfortunate people, deadly according to age. And this analysis by Kostoff, and that's the reason why I'm showing you the evidence. So I'm not giving you information or misinformation. I'm just giving you the published papers that you can go read yourself on the internet. Every one of these, you can just type in and find it. If you want a copy of the slides, Jonathan will give you a copy of the slides. You can review it yourself. I'm just giving you the evidence as a doctor. I'm in this field. I publish manuscripts. I'm an editor of a major journal. I know what I'm talking about in terms of the peer-reviewed publication. This analysis by Kostoff showed that the age relationship to the respiratory illness on the left of the slide and the vaccine deaths, it's the same age relationship. And Kostoff concluded that a novel best-case scenario analysis showed very conservatively that there's five times as many deaths attributable to each vaccine shot than there are attributable to COVID-19 in people over age 65. Because here's the thing, if you're over 65 and you say, and you just, the vast majority of people over 65 took the vaccine, so it's kind of water under the bridge. But if someone decided, you know, I'm not going to take it, it's not 100% you're going to run into COVID-19. There's a less than 1% chance you're going to even run into the virus. And then if you run into the virus, you can be strong enough to survive it or get treatment and survive it, right? But if you take the vaccine, it's 100% chance it's in your body. It's 100% deterministic. And I think that's the difference here. And this analysis was presented to the US FDA on September 17th, just a few weeks ago, at their booster meeting. This is one seminal piece of information that was presented. Jessica Rose has shown in a separate paper that the non-fatal injuries fall in basically three major areas: brain, heart, and the immune system. And they tend to occur quickly after the vaccines, and they tend to skew towards younger people. This analysis that was published in Annals of Hepatology described, in a sense, whole new illnesses. This is called vaccine-induced thrombocytopenic purpuria. There are problems that develop with the blood clotting system that begin to affect organs after the vaccine. These are described, this is the doctor's literature. So the vaccine has created new medical problems that are being published in our medical literature. Here's one about hypertension, published in one of our journals in cardiology, the Journal of Hypertension, and it's called Stage 3 Hypertension in Patients After the Vaccine. So some people with high blood pressure do get a skyrocketing of blood pressure in their body. We can't predict who's going to happen, but it can be disastrous. There's a young man in my circles in Dallas who his aorta, the major blood tube, ripped. It's called an aortic dissection about 2 days after the vaccine. A 42-year-old man, this should not happen. Laura Ingram on Fox, I'm a frequent contributor to Fox on the Ingram Angle, she brought on a woman in her 70s where this happened to her. Blood pressure shot up and she started having bleeding into the brain about 2 days after the vaccine. She was neurologically devastated and she's very regretful she took the vaccine, but she was just telling her story. Granted, the majority of people, they took the vaccine and everything worked out fine, but there were people like her, like the young man I described, along the way that were being injured. And so the vaccine itself started taking on incredible focus in terms of safety as the agenda seemed to move from the seniors to the children. And if you notice today, if you notice any of the media cycles, you don't hear much discussion about the seniors. Listen, the seniors are still getting COVID and they are the people dying of COVID, but there seems to be a hyper focus on young people. You know, children, and the governor of California just announced they're gonna vaccinate all the children. Well, the FDA is warning us that this can happen, that the vaccines can injure the hearts of children, called myocarditis. And this paper was published from the University of California at Davis by Tracy Hoag. And the paper is using several data sources. It's a very good analysis on myocarditis. And what she's concluded is that the myocarditis, that 86% of the time when the heart is injured, and there's already been 6,000 cases of this, but 86% of the time the young people require hospitalization. They have severe chest pain, they have EKG changes, elevations in blood troponin, reductions in heart pumping function, sometimes early development of heart failure. I tell you, it's tragic to see a young person developing heart failure, but it's happening. And that her analysis was that these vaccine-induced myocarditis hospitalizations are more likely to happen in a young person than getting hospitalized with COVID-19. So, and this was also presented at the US FDA September 17th meeting. So the proposition of taking a vaccine, as we understand it today, is that it's actually, in a sense, poses a great, these are low frequency, but a greater danger for those who had taken the vaccine as opposed to taking your chances. And the FDA didn't dispute this. They did not dispute this. The advisory panel for boosters voted 16-2, no boosters. So I can tell you, having some external experts at the US FDA meeting, there were six of them, was very helpful to have a dialogue. And that's the reason why we're here tonight, is we're just trying to have a dialogue and get medical information out without any other agenda. Nobody here in the room has an agenda outside of trying to learn. More information from the Hoag paper demonstrating a very tight temporal relationship up on the left between the vaccine and getting the heart damage, and that it's far more likely to happen after dose two, shown in the lower panel, far more happened in young men than young women. And the final panel on the lower right, that what's really happening is even more than what the CDC and FDA knew about in June. That can that shows you how important it is to have regular safety information. We had no idea coming out of the clinical trials that the vaccines could get to the heart and damage the heart. We had no idea. And to be fair to Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, they had no idea. The US FDA had no idea. When these things started out in December, you know, I didn't have any problem with the vaccines. They were about 90% effective, is what we were told, and they were reasonably clean on safety, is what we told. And I looked at the briefing booklet, and that was the case. So no one was deceiving America, but what we've learned is after release of the vaccines, and we started using it into a broad population, we started to see it. So without protection from the pharmaceutical laws and our general regulatory operating principles, we're in trouble. Unless we actually have some stopgap here, this is going to continue to go along, and it's not just in the United States. Similar concerns are occurring all over the world. So the United Kingdom, they actually got off to vaccinating ahead of us. They have Pfizer, Moderna, and they have AstraZeneca developed with Oxford. And I can tell you that the evidence-based consulting group in England, which is the principal consulting group for the World Health Organization by contract, is led by this doctor, Dr. Tess Lowry, who's a very, very credible scientist, epidemiologist, and physician. I've personally interviewed her for the McCullough Report. Their recommendations in June were that the vaccines are not safe enough for human use. We've seen enough. Shut it down. This went to the UK government in what's from the yellow card system. So this is not from the US data. So the same safety problems were being seen in England, and the recommendation was shut it down. There was great concern that started to well up in the late spring. There were citizen petition groups filed by doctors and by nurses to the FDA saying, don't approve the vaccines. This is not looking good for the vaccines. Remember, the majority of people had already taken the vaccine by April timeframe. So it wasn't a lot of people getting the vaccines beyond April 8th, but you know, there was kind of a natural pause as all this came in. Now, when the FDA met on August 23rd to approve the Pfizer vaccine, there were no external advisors, there were no external presenters, it was just the FDA and Pfizer. No review panel, no voting. Okay. Pfizer was not approved. It was not approved. They got a continuation of the emergency use authorization. The biotechnology partner, BioNTech, a German company, got conditional approval of a legally distinct vaccine that's probably a little bit medicinally distinct is what we're told, and that's called Comirnaty. That got conditional approval, but conditional upon doing a lot more study about myocarditis in the heart and with a lot of warnings on use in pregnancy, because we didn't know if it was safe in pregnancy. It's right in their proposed label. What came out of that meeting was a false talking point that went all the way up to the President of the United States to say Pfizer was approved when it wasn't. And everybody in my circle said, wait a minute, we had petitions in there saying don't approve it. In fact, our petitions were right, they didn't approve it. The person who signed the letter to Comirnaty, to BioNTech, Dr. Gruber of the FDA, very senior official at the FDA, in the middle of a very big regulatory cycle, right? This is the biggest thing the vaccines division has ever done, she resigns. She resigns as a signal that something potentially bad is going on. So that's what we knew about vaccine safety and lack of approval. But people have asked, wait a minute, doctor, I've took the vaccine. What did I get out of it? Is it protecting me? What about vaccine efficacy? How are the vaccines working? The CDC has been slow to publish how the vaccines are working, but this paper did catch my eye. It was published September 17th, a few weeks ago, and it's calculating vaccine efficacy, meaning, in a sense, how are the vaccines theoretically protecting somebody from COVID-19? So you can see as the top, against protecting against hospitalization, Moderna looking pretty good, 92% protection. Now, Moderna is 100 micrograms of messenger RNA. It's a big dose. Pfizer's 30 micrograms of messenger RNA. A lot of people don't know that. Moderna is three times as strong as Pfizer. They're very different. Johnson & Johnson, even more different because it's the adenoviral technology. They had Pfizer at 77% and Johnson & Johnson at 68%. And so this is the calling card to say that it looks like the vaccines, at least from January forward through the spring, were protecting against hospitalization. Indeed, that was happening. But the caveat in the paper was, we're not taking into consideration the Delta variant, the new variant that hit. This was with the legacy variants, which was on their way out. And so failure of the vaccines with respect to Delta started coming out in stories. One of the stories was the naval cruise vessel, where all the young sailors in Britain were all fully vaccinated. How did they get Delta on the ship? How did they get it? There was a wedding in Houston. Everyone was vaccinated. They came down with Delta. How did that happen? There was a flight, a Democratic lawmaker flight from Texas to Washington. They got Delta on the flight, and they were all vaccinated. And then they saw Kamala Harris, and then she scrambled to Walter Reed. They thought maybe she got it. So we started to have these news cycles to say, wait a minute, fully vaccinated people now are getting the Delta variant. Is it possible that the Delta could be escaping the vaccines? Well, then the CDC tells us in a paper. The CDC, by the way, has their own journal. It's a peer-reviewed journal. It's very good. MMWR. MMWR, July 30th, they chronicle the Barnstable County outbreak. This is a county in Massachusetts. There were some congregate settings. They had very good sequencing data there. They were doing a good outbreak assessment. And as you can see here, the light blue, there's more fully vaccinated people getting sick with COVID than unvaccinated people. That's not supposed to happen. The vaccines are supposed to keep you from getting COVID-19, not allow us. And the CDC is telling us in this outbreak. And so I was on one time, I think, with Laura Ingram, and we discussed this. Well, the Mayo Clinic and a company in Boston called Inference, they've got a great data set of sequenced. That means they know the variant of COVID-19. Rochester, Minnesota, they have 25,000 people there, and they had calculated that the vaccine efficacy, the protection, was still holding out for Moderna against Delta at 76%, but it had fallen greatly for Pfizer at 42%. Now, in general, a vaccine should at least give you 50% protection and at least last a year. That's what's called the acceptance criteria. If a vaccine can't do that, it's considered kind of useless. We wouldn't take a vaccine for a couple percentage of protection. It's just not worth the safety risk. So Pfizer looked like it was slipping. And then we had data from Israel starting to come in, and you don't need to be an epidemiologist for this. If you look at the columns, the percent fully vaccinated in Israel, adults, 86%. The cases of COVID-19 fully vaccinated are 84%. They're overlapping. Everybody in Israel, effectively, who's getting COVID-19 is fully vaccinated. They have 2 million people who have gotten boosters. It's all Delta. It should be obvious the vaccines are not holding down the epidemic. And this is the reason why you guys are standing here, is because these data are not presented on TV. They're not presented to you fairly. They're being scrubbed off of YouTube. They're being scrubbed off of Twitter, because in a sense, the goal was to promote the vaccine and squash anybody's hesitancy. Well, this would make you pretty hesitant, wouldn't you think, if that everybody who took the vaccine are getting COVID-19. Now, their Delta outbreak in Israel is bigger than the pre-vaccinated outbreak. So it's even worse now than it was before the vaccine. And the same is true in Singapore, the same is true in Iceland, the same is true partially in the United Kingdom. Thankfully, in the United States, our Delta outbreak is going to be about 2/3 of our pre-vaccination outbreak. We've kept it down with early treatment, but this ought to be, I think, fairly convincing evidence to you that our CDC, the Mayo Clinic, Israel, at least for Pfizer, is telling us that Pfizer has failed as a vaccine. Our CDC started to tell us this spring against the older variants that the vaccines were not airtight. So in this report, the CDC told us that they have a total of 10,000 vaccine failure cases, of which 10% were hospitalized and 2% died. That didn't sound too good, and that was with the older variants. Remember, they're supposed to be 90%. This isn't the universe of cases, but they had 10,000 vaccine failures. For those of you who've had COVID-19, how many people here have had COVID-19? Okay, we're in good company, about half of you. During this time period, the CDC did not log a single failure of natural immunity. Not a single failure of natural immunity, but they had logged 10,000 on their website. This is from the website, 10,000 vaccine failures. And one of the things that was disturbing to me is we started to hear things from our director of the National Allergy and Immunology branch of the NIH and our US Surgeon General. They actually came on TV multiple times and told America that the vaccine was better than natural immunity while this was happening. And that's the reason why people started to say, listen, that's not acceptable. As Americans, it's not acceptable. The CDC and NIH and FDA work for us. They're public servants. They work for us. They work for doctors and patients. Doctors and patients sit, this is very important. They serve us. They serve us with data. They serve us with regulatory capabilities, drug safety. If anything, the FDA must ensure drug safety, okay? And then the doctor and patient decide. That's called the fiduciary relationship. You know, the doctor is the one who takes on the responsibility. Something happens to you, your doctor is responsible for you. And the doctor and the patient make a decision together. It's called shared decision making. And so do you know every drug and every test that you've ever had in your life, it's a negotiation. We kind of talk about it. We decide, well, maybe this, maybe that, I'll go for this. I do this all day long. I had a ton of patients in the office yesterday. We negotiated everything. That's part of the art and science of medicine. We do not practice medicine by being issued rulings. And one time I did a press interview and someone goes, Dr. McCullough, what do you think about the most recent CDC ruling? I said, ruling? What are they, the Supreme Court? I mean, the CDC says you should eat less than 10% of calories in sugar and saturated fat. Now, is that a ruling? I think I just violated that with a barbecue upstairs. But, they can give guidance and the FDA can give guidance. And you know, the FDA gives all kinds of warnings. Doctors interpret that, but it doesn't mean we don't use the drugs that we need to use. FDA warnings are never a reason not to do things. But the CDC kept going on. So this is CDC report now from July 26. Now they've got 6587 vaccine failures, and they have 19% of them have died. So this is looking pretty serious, okay? A large number of those with seniors. Next report, CDC website, August 23rd. Now they have 11,050 vaccine failures, and they have 87% of the deaths are over age 65, and 70% of those hospitalized over 65. This isn't the universe of cases, but this is the ones that have spontaneously come through the network of Departments of Community Health. So I'm telling you, the CDC knew, even with the older variants, that the vaccines were failing. And in fact, seniors were being hospitalized and died. It's on their website. And that explains why some of our loved ones who are fully vaccinated got sick. Now, there are two important papers that have just emerged, one from Havers and colleagues on the left, and one from Fillmore and colleagues on the right. The one from the left is from the CDC COVID-Net Network, and the one from the right is from the Veterans Administration, okay? And they chronicled who in the hospital was vaccinated. Do you know if someone goes to the hospital right now, the hospital doesn't know who's been vaccinated. It's all by self-report. People don't bring their vaccine cards. A lot of times, have you ever been in the hospital? You don't have time to even pack your pajamas half the time. People are not going to bring their vaccine card and people aren't going to log them. They actually don't know. And so what happened was, I think it was in June, there was a talking point, I think it was issued by some of the agencies, where it said 99% of people in the hospital were unvaccinated. Remember hearing that? It was almost like a montage and they showed everybody 99%. How can it be 99%? Well, Havers, using CDC data through June, and Fillmore, using VA data, 23% of Americans in the hospital partially through June were vaccinated. That 99% talking point is not real. It's not. These are the only published data that we have, and it wasn't even close to 99%. It was 77% were unvaccinated. Now remember, I showed you this proposition, right? So starting in April, people stopped taking the vaccine. And so if someone chooses not to take the vaccine and they end up in the hospital, they have taken that gamble. But they've taken a more intelligent gamble in the sense, because they were more likely to die with the vaccine. And people started to know this, and it's supported by those two papers. Now, if we go forward, these are data from CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, through a very good project showing how Delta has shaded in through August. And what they found now is that 60% of Americans over age 65 in hospital today through the first week of August, fully 60% are vaccinated. Okay? It's a fair game. Both the vaccinated and unvaccinated are being hospitalized. And I've heard doctors in a very pejorative way say that, oh, the vaccinated are coming in, almost with the vitriol, that it's the vaccinated are clogging up the hospitals. Well, you know what? It's the vaccinated, bless their hearts, they're the ones who are also paralyzed and they have injuries and we're taking care of them. And 200,000 vaccinated have been hospitalized after the vaccines. 15,000 vaccinated have lost their lives to the vaccine. 20,000 vaccinated are in wheelchairs or permanently disabled. So this idea of being pejorative, and I had a conference call with a doctor who had actually trained at my center, he was in an ICU, and the very first thing he had to tell me, he had to report how many people in his ICU were unvaccinated. I said, you know what? I never asked that question. You know why? Because I treat them the same. I will never show a single bit of discrimination. It's wrong. It's wrong. And if any doctor in your circles in any way seems to look down at you because you've chosen to either take or not take the vaccine, then I think you should step up and have a little feedback conversation with that doctor. That's really important. That's really important. I had a distressed mother call me, who's about my age, and said, my daughter's pregnant, she's 6 months pregnant, and her obstetrician says he won't deliver the baby unless she takes the vaccine. And I said, well, the vaccines weren't tested on pregnant women. They're not, we don't know if they're safe or not. And she goes, what should you do? She goes, go back and demand standard obstetrical care. We know in pregnancy, as an example, there's a paper by Pinellas and colleagues published in Annals of Internal Medicine, pregnant women have an easier time with COVID than non-pregnant women the same age. At some points in time, pregnant women in labor and delivery departments were 5, 10, 15% testing positive. They get through it. Even if a pregnant woman has severe symptoms, they can easily treat it with the drugs I'm going to go over with you. So this idea that, you know, so the question is, what's in the doctor's mind? Is the doctor trying to protect himself or herself? Do they think, ooh, I'm going to make sure they're vaccinated so I don't get it? Is that the thinking? Or is there some other type of distorted thinking? We, in pregnancy, the only thing we allow is tetanus, inactivated flu, and inactivated pertussis. That's it. DPT. That's it. Nothing beyond that. We would never allow a dangerous biologic substance to be injected in a pregnant woman's body. And the vaccines here, at least with respect to hospitalization, look like they don't work fully to protect American seniors. Now, in the CMS data, in this study, 80% of people over 65 took the vaccine. So it's not like we have a lot more people to take the vaccine. You can see that this was our curve. This was our pre-vaccination curve in December, and the U.S. Senate hearings occurred at early treatment in November. We started really ramping up the treatment networks. We crushed our curve. We kept things down, the vaccine program rolled up, and then we had the Delta outbreak, and the Delta virus is not covered by the vaccines. That's the problem. So in my view, by pushing vaccination, we've, in a sense, kind of played with Mother Nature. So we've always had 6 to 12 different strains. There's people have different colored hair. You know, if you get a staphylococcal strain, there's a bunch of different strains. But if we put a change in the population was called a non-lethal evolutionary pressure. It's like treating everybody here with the same antibiotic. I guarantee some people would get resistant strains of bacteria. It's just the way Mother Nature works. And this paper by Neeson and colleagues show, sure enough, as soon as we started vaccinating, we started dropping diversity of strains of the virus. We used to have alpha, beta, lambda. We've always had a little delta. But now what happened is diversity went way down and the Delta variant emerged. So we fooled with Mother Nature. And there were vaccinologists and virologists who were really making a lot of noise early on, including Dr. Luc Montier. He won the Nobel Prize in France. Dr. Michael Yaden, who used to be a senior developer for Pfizer. Dr. Geir Vandenbosch, who used to work for the Gates Foundation. Dr. Byron Bridle, who's a vaccinologist in Canada. Yeah, I'm a clinical internist and cardiologist, but it even made sense to me that, wait a minute, we shouldn't be, the vaccine I thought was going to be for nursing home workers and seniors. I thought it was going to be protect the vulnerable, not to just broadly to have everybody take it, because we could, in a sense, fool with Mother Nature and start to mess with genetic diversity. And that's exactly what happened. What this paper from Venkata Krishnan shows, that light gray blob is the spike protein, and then the dark gray blob is an antibody. Notice the antibody is much bigger than the spike protein. What happened with Delta is the spike protein changed its conformation, and the antibodies depended on that little green zone. That's called an epitope to bind. The virus mutated, so the antibodies can't hit it. So with Pfizer, they're getting plenty of antibodies, but the Pfizer antibodies can't hit it. It looks like Moderna can hit it partially. That's what we have. It's called antigenic escape. So the Delta variant is a big deal because we're stuck with it now because of mass vaccination. These are the CDC sequencing data that come out every 2 weeks. You can see that we've had this emergence, and if I could show you this 2 years ago, it was actually a colored stacked bar graph of all these different variants. Now we have a solid bar of orange. It's 99% Delta. So when you go get a test for COVID, all they can tell you is positive or negative. But the departments of community health have sequencing where they can tell you what variant it is, and it's all Delta. It's all Delta at this point in time. It's the most mutated form of the virus. The spike protein has 7 mutations for sure. There's Delta plus with an 8th mutation, and then there's 20 more that's sprinkled through the nucleocapsid and other targets. So the bottom line is the virus is mutated to escape the effect of the vaccine. And now we're seeing it in this recent paper that just came forward from the University of California at Davis, fully vaccinated, not vaccinated. Fully vaccinated, not vaccinated. And you can see here, those are all the dots. They look the same. I'm telling you, the vaccinated can have in the nose and mouth the same amount of virus as somebody who's unvaccinated. It's as if they're no different from one another in this study. Second paper from the Wisconsin Department of Public Health. Look on the left, vaccinated, unvaccinated. Those are the viral counts in what's called the cycle threshold. No difference. Look on the right. This is infectivity in the lab. Infectious. No difference. So this idea that someone should take the vaccine to protect somebody else at this point in time is completely fallacious. It's not supported. The vaccinated carry the virus as much as the unvaccinated. They're all the same. Those of you in the room who took the vaccine or didn't, it doesn't matter. You're all the same. The only people who can't carry virus like this are the people who've already had COVID-19. You're immune. You're done. Okay? So we need a pivot to early treatment. I've made the case that many of you have taken the vaccine. The vaccines aren't safe enough in everyone, and the vaccines aren't protective enough in everyone for us to ignore treatment. So we must have a focus on treatment. People are protesting because all over the place there's been a suppression of early treatment and at the same time an overpromotion of the vaccine. And when I went on Tucker Carlson, I didn't ask to go on. His producers called me and they said, can you come meet Tucker Carlson? He wants to talk to you. I went to his studio and I started explaining to him. I said, Tucker, I'm just a doctor. I'm just trying to explain to you what's going on. But something is going on. It seems like treatment is being actively suppressed and people are being made to have fear and isolation and suffering and hospitalization and death at the same time. The vaccine is being wildly promoted, over-promoted by doctors, by all the different stakeholders. There's a mass psychosis that's going on. And he kept going, what's going on? Who's doing this? Families are going to court, getting court orders to tell the hospitals to treat patients correctly. Something is going on. Something is in the minds of doctors and healthcare administrators where they are not thinking correctly. This is unprecedented that people would have to do this. We have a situation where the public and private outrage over the ineffective and unsafe treatment programs, including the vaccines, is really coming to a head. We have a situation where now even discussion of this, there's censorship. So even us getting together and just talking about this is considered public participation, that we are publicly participating in a topic of interest. Someone's got a great phone. And it's probably a good time to end. That's probably the alarm. But you know, we're being censored. This is really important. Ron Johnson, who was the majority witness when I testified in the Senate, you know, he's been on to this. He said, wait a minute, doctors should be doctors. Doctors, no two doctors agree. They never do. No two lawyers agree. We should have teams of doctors talking. America should see teamwork on TV. We should be having conferences and having consensus decision. One time I was on Laura Ingraham, and you know, I don't want to criticize public health officials because, you know, I honestly, I don't think that's respectful, but probably the most edgy thing I said was I said, listen, America is in a sense looking on TV and they hear from a medical dictator. They're hearing from one person. Where's the teamwork? Where's the group of doctors that can basically show a consensus that we have a situation where there is this censorship? Doctors are now afraid to talk about this. Do you know some doctors in town were kind of afraid to show up? They were afraid to talk, and it's like, that shouldn't happen. I'm not that intimidating of a person. You know, they would have met me if we would go out to dinner and talk about cholesterol or diabetes. That would have been fine. But suddenly COVID, people feel uncomfortable. 2 years ago, I was the endowed lecturer at Harvard. And I went to Harvard, and there was all this fanfare. My wife went, and we went out to dinner, and there's all this all these gala events. It was a wonderful experience. Harvard, absolutely wonderful. Just a beacon of academic excellence in the United States. Do you know this year I was the invited, endowed lecturer, named lecturer of another Ivy League school? And I was going to come this spring. And they said, what's your topic? I said, treatment of COVID-19. He goes, what? He goes, that's not your field. I said, it is now. I said, I've been working on this for a long time. He goes, we've had a lot of lectures on COVID-19. We've had a ton of lectures on COVID-19. I said, yeah, but you ever had a lecture on how to treat it? He goes, no. I said, well, there you go. And he goes, well, okay. So I fill out all these forms and contracts and conflict of interest and assignments and copyright assignments and slides. We go through all this work. Then 11 o'clock the night before the lecture, Dr. McCullough, there's a problem. I said, what? They said, we can't have you give this lecture. I said, why not? I did everything by the book. They said, our entire infectious disease department went to the chairman of medicine and said, we cannot let Dr. McCullough deliver this message. That is suppression of information to young doctors. It's getting worse. This is a threat letter that I received and all the doctors who are board certified received that said, listen, if somehow somebody accuses you or you're positioned in a way to be viewed as giving misinformation, you can lose your board certification and medical license. That's pretty serious. That's like losing your contractor license. That's like losing your real estate license. That means your job goes away. Who decides information? Who decides misinformation? I haven't given you any information tonight. I've given you data. You're going to decide. But I got to tell you, it's unprecedented to receive threats like this. I can tell you, I can imagine probably in early Nazi Germany, doctors received letters like this. So there is an active hunting that's going on. It's an active hunting. And it's the most disturbing thing. Do you know people have made fake Wikipedia pages on me? I'm not famous enough to have a Wikipedia page, but somebody made a Wikipedia page. And you know, I'm locked out of it. I can't change it. They can put anything on there they want to. And there's not a darn thing I can do about it. I recently went on with Ben Marble, and I'm showing you Ben Marble, good guy. He started MyFreeDoctor.com. MyFreeDoctor.com is an internet telemedicine service that operates in all 50 states. It operates 24/7, and it's free. And so sick people with COVID-19 go on MyFreeDoctor.com, and they get medicines called in, typically to local community pharmacies who will fill them so they can get treatment for COVID-19. Bless his heart. And if you feel so inclined, you can give a charitable donation. It's a charity. But the bottom line is Ben Marble is a modern day American hero. MyFreeDoctor.com. But there are dark times going on. Maybe you here are aware that myself and my wife are being under attack. My former employer, Baylor Scott & White Health System, that basically effectively terminated my contract after nearly 10 years of perfect service at the end of January, for no reason, my interpretation, because I treated COVID-19 patients, has turned around and sued me now the day they announced the vaccine mandates. I think the reason why they sued me is they wanted to show that they mean business. And that any doctor who's going to speak out in any type of truthful fashion, they're going to crush them. They're going to try to crush me. Okay? Now, this report by this reporter is completely false. There was a temporary restraining order in July 28th that restrained me to my separation agreement and my contract, which I've always honored. And there's no restraining order that says I can't go out and deliver a lecture, or I can't go on Fox News or Tucker Carlson or go on on Sean Hannity. This is false. What this person is doing is false. This went out to every single doctor in America. I think intentionally, you know, it says I'm a skeptic. You know what? I am a skeptic. So are you. That the lifeblood of science is to be skeptical. That's actually what we're supposed to do. I mean, but you, can you imagine if the title was Doctor Who's Blindly Following Advice? I mean, think about the opposite. Of course, skeptical is what you're supposed to be. I mean, you're what you're supposed to be. Now, I've said one of the reasons why every seat is filled here is I think people sense something's going on in the world. Something's going on in the world that's bigger than COVID. Okay, we've been talking about COVID, like we're fighting COVID, but go to Australia, something is bigger. They have hardly any COVID there. On most days, they have more vaccine deaths than COVID deaths. They're harming themselves with the vaccine. They're at the point where they don't even let each other even go to work or go to school. They're absolutely miserable. Probably half my emails come from Australia. They're at the point of shooting rubber bullets at each other for no reason. You know, Melbourne is like San Diego. Sydney is a wonderful city. It's a very Americanized. Australia is just like this. What is in their minds? What is in the minds of people right now where they are doing bad things to one another for no reason? It can't be about COVID. They don't have it. They don't have hardly any COVID. There's something in the minds of people. Just like the virus is infectious, what people are saying is we're under a mass psychosis, that we've had 18 months of fear, of isolation, of loneliness. We've seen death. We've seen harm. And now we're in a mental cycle with one another, and it's worldwide. People are in what's called lockstep. Every country is in lockstep with one another. Take the vaccine. Okay, I took it. What next? Take a booster. Okay, I took a booster. What next? You're going to lose your job. Wait a minute, I lose my job. Everybody now is somehow under some type of threat all over the world. Australia, can't leave your house, can't go 5 kilometers, can't go 2 people. You know, how many more restrictions can they think up for Australia? It's ridiculous. They're so spread out. So something is in the minds of people. And I'm telling you, it's all over. And it has nothing to do with Pfizer or Moderna or Twitter or Facebook. I've done some things on Clubhouse, this kind of conversation platform on my phone, where people drop in from the most remote places of South America and Africa. And it'll be some young doctor saying, Dr. McCullough, this patient had COVID. I knew I could treat him, but my senior doctor said, don't treat him, let him die. Whoa, that is awful. And doctors have dialed in from Scandinavia saying, you know how we treat COVID in the nursing home? About 40 milligrams of morphine. We actually put him down. It's euthanasia. I said, you got to be kidding me. They said, no, it's common. And people's hearts are broken. They're in their minds. Something is going on. I'm just going to leave you with this, and I'm going to tell you, I am convinced of it. There is a dark cloud that's come over the world in the last 2 years. It may have been going on much longer than this, where people's eyes are clouded. They're not thinking correctly. Their hearts are hardened. And there is a small group of people that have eyes to see, ears to hear, and a warm heart. And you can tell who's who. Something is going on in the world in a very special way right now. I'll let you try to conclude what's going on, but the effort to try to figure this out is extraordinary. People have said, who's behind it? Tucker Carlson said, I want to know who's behind it. Well, there's a lot of people behind it. There's a lot of people profiting, but I'm not sure it's all profit that's driven 700,000 deaths, 20,000 permanently injured Americans from the vaccine. This book, Peter Bregan, COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are the Prey, is the best assemblage of what's going on so far. It's got 1,000 references. It will show you the parts of the pandemic that were planned out. It will show you how Moderna had the material transfer agreement with the Chinese for the code to the spike protein before COVID came out. I mean, the stuff was going on. I think everybody knows this. Rand Paul is on it. He's on right now. He knows what's going on. So there's something going on. You know, if a blockbuster drug earned in its first years of sales After all the research and development with the sales force, if a blockbuster drug earned $1 billion, it'd be a blockbuster. Pfizer, with no sales force for COVID-19 vaccines, with no development costs since the government paid for it, Pfizer's earned $33 billion. So clearly, it doesn't work. Clearly, we have a situation where there are people profiting from this. Something is going on. I'm not sure the profit is all behind it. It doesn't explain how it's happening in the most remote places in the earth, but it's somehow linked to getting a needle in every arm, that's for sure. I mean, people in Indonesia are on their knees because they can't get their government checks unless they take the vaccine. The military is going to be decommissioned unless they take the vaccine. Some of you are going to lose your jobs, you think, or you'll be threatening to lose your jobs over the vaccine. How can you lose your job over a vaccine that's not safe enough and doesn't work well enough, that's not a fully approved, and that you don't agree to? You don't lose your job over a pill that you refuse to take. I mean, something's going on. So I'm going to say, I'm going to finish and conclude by saying you've been very patient, that COVID-19 pandemic is a global disaster. How it happens is very complex. It is real, and it is a lethal infection that's complicated. A single drug's not going to handle it. We have to use drugs in combination. We must treat early to prevent hospitalization and death. And we can prevent hospitalization and death. We can't let grandmother sit for 2 weeks at home, getting progressively ill, and let her go in the hospital and then let the hospital save her. It's not working. It's not working. We must treat early at home. Use any and all available drugs that we know works. The genetic vaccines, Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson, are just not safe enough and don't work well enough for everybody to be forced to take it. Now, if someone wants to take it or has taken it and has done well, and they can find a position in their life for it, and if it's medical freedom and voluntary, fine. There's going to be better vaccines coming. Way better vaccines are going to be way safer in development. Like the first of anything, a lot of the first drugs are not so good compared to the later ones. Lastly, censorship and reprisal are working to crush a very, very important part of our lives. Interchange of information, fair opportunity to ask questions, fair opportunity. Everything I showed you tonight is citable. You can find it on the internet. Anybody who wants the slides, Jonathan Boulding will send you the slides, scrutinize them, scrutinize the references. I've presented to you today a fair balance of information as a doctor. I'm an academically accomplished doctor. I'm considered among the most accomplished in the United States, if not the world. And I'm here tonight mainly because I just care about what's going on with the country. And you do too. Thank you.
Questions?
Yeah, we're going to get some microphones for questions, and I'm happy to take them. You know, this was a 90-minute lecture, and so if you're going to college credit, you guys all would have gotten an A for just making it all the way through. If you have to stand up, but let me just ask you a favor. Please don't ask regarding your own medical questions and what you should do and about your grandmother and stuff. Just try to make it so everybody can learn from the question. People always want to divulge everything. They're not supposed to. Okay, you're first up.
We're going to try this. Good evening, Dr. McCullough.
Yes.
Thank you for being in Bartlesville. I'm Joel Rabin. First, it's all about control. And answer your question. It is all about control. Secondly, we have a situation here where a group of employed physicians by the local hospital, not voluntary physicians, employed physicians by the hospital, insist that everybody, and I guess their mother and their dogs, need to get vaccinated. So I got three questions. One, how do we stop these guys from spreading this garbage? Two, how do we get rid of Dr. Fauci? And three, how do we get the US Supreme Court to expedite all these cases that this is unconstitutional and illegal? Thank you.
Yep. Okay. The first question has to do with kind of the medical thought pattern. And I think every patient is going to, doctors right now, a lot of them, they seem to be in a trance where the only thing they can think of is the vaccine. They've been actually told, if you should see the doctor's emails, we've been told for 18 months, the only thing we can do is promote the vaccine. That's the only thing we've been told. And doctors, in a sense, have been brainwashed into this trance. And I think only a few really have clear eyes. And each week, more doctors, in a sense, suddenly the light bulb turns on. Wait a minute, we can treat this, and the vaccines may not be safe. But you should probably show them that red box report and say, doctor, if you want me to take the vaccine, there's been 15,000 Americans that have died and 250,000 have been in the hospital. Do you want me to be in one of these red boxes? How do I avoid that? Doctor, there are analyses now showing I'm more likely to die with the vaccine than die with COVID. I'm better off taking my chances. You know, and start to have a dialogue. Doctors need to hear that right now, because if they don't hear it, what patients are doing is they're giving up on their doctors. And they say, Dr. McCullough, my doctor just wants me to take the vaccine. Can you do my get out of jail free card? It's like, oh my gosh, you know, can you imagine 300 million people want that? It's like, no, you got to interact with your doctor. Your next question was, how do we deal with the public officials? So the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Immunology branch, that's a division head, which actually is not that high of a post in the NIH. It's okay, but it's not that high. The point is, yesterday, his boss, the head of the NIH, just resigned. Okay, that's that. We've already had two of the key FDA virology people resign. Anytime things start to topple, you'll start to see resignations, and there may be more. The last point was, what about the Supreme Court? This gets to a very important question about fairness. I told you how people are kind of brainwashed now with this mass psychosis. I don't think there's any fairness right now. This idea of, oh, we're going to go to a court and finally a Supreme Court, they'll understand. Or finally the judge will. No, they're just as clouded as the doctors. There is a mass psychosis. I don't think we can expect fairness. I think we're going to need to use our methods of dealing in a rational and congenial and friendly manner with one another to bring ourselves out of the trance. We can't go to some third party who suddenly sees everything clearly and adjudicates in our favor. It's not going to happen.
Thank you so much for being here and doing everything you're doing. I'm Dr. Debbie Gladfoley. I'm a rheumatologist from Tulsa, and I have been prescribing for my patients everything that you've been saying for about the last 4 months, and yes, there has been some kickback from it, but I appreciate what you're doing. I have four questions. First of all, I've implemented Pepcid. I've recently read some research about Pepcid and the antihistamine properties that COVID requires, and I was wondering what your opinion was about Pepcid use.
Let me take one by one, because
sure.
So Pepcid is famotidine. It's available over the counter. President Trump received it. It is mildly assistive, and I agree with you that because it reduces a little bit of the viral entry and it doesn't have much in the way of side effects, and it's an antihistamine, that's a good add-on. Just probably two or three other things. By the way, what I've put up on the board for you, probably add on another dozen things that are assistive. Go ahead.
Secondly, in your four pillar slide, the fourth pillar talked about vaccination rendering herd immunity. What we now know about the deleterious effects potentially of the vaccine and the superior outcomes with natural immunity, would you possibly alter that fourth pillar to suggest that herd immunity is truly only achieved through someone who has survived the infection?
Yeah, I agree with that. When I wrote the paper, I the way it was put, it was that herd immunity through natural immunity assisted by vaccination.
Your point is, it looks like
vaccination is not going to contribute much, and that's a good point. The natural immunity, by the way, is going to carry us, and even if someone has taken the vaccine, they get sick and they get natural immunity, then they're good. So natural immunity is the backstop. Yeah.
Third question. As a rheumatologist, I deal with autoimmune diseases every day, and basically what I see is that this vaccine has now created a new strain of autoimmune disease by causing the cell to make something that shouldn't be there.
Right.
And now the antibodies, the immune system, is being taught to fight something that is constantly being, that's an autoimmune disease. This is what I treat people for, to stop autoimmune diseases, and now we're creating it?
We're creating it, and the question is, gee, just from the first one or two shots, how long is it there? I think the paper that Bruce Patterson just presented in Rome, showing with a natural infection, the spike proteins in the body for 15 months, is really disturbing. I mean, come on, most of us have had it. I've had it. I don't like the idea it's still in my body, and let alone take a vaccine and make your body produce it and then give a booster and then produce it again. This idea of loading the body with genetic material to produce the spike protein, it sounds like a bad idea, and it is.
Okay, and my final comment or question is, I have provided several patients with the religious exemption letter that I found on Sydney Powell's newsletter that she does, you know, frequently during the week, and it's been very useful for some of my patients. For others, it has been declined. And so now I'm kind of moving toward medical exemption since the vaccine was accepted. And so the medical exemption, do you happen to have a form medical exemption example that we could just like plug in the way Sydney's Powell's religious exemption?
No, I don't. But the concept is, as a medical doctor, I think the medical exemption is based on risks and benefits, right? So any underlying condition along a known area of injury is just a setup for a disaster. So let's say someone has multiple sclerosis. Well, okay, if they get neurologic injury, now they can go from being functional to being in a wheelchair. What if someone's had a prior stroke? Same application. What about prior heart disease? Then get the myocarditis. For trouble. What about prior cancers? There's already been papers published on this. Patients with prior cancers do very poorly with the vaccine. All kinds of problems. Same thing with blood disorders and autoimmune disorders. So people along those categories, it's based on risks and benefits. But that question that says, did you have a fatal reaction to the vaccine? The answer is no, not yet, but I don't want to be. And you check that box.
Thank you.
Very good. Yes. And we'll go fast. I know it's been long.
Hi. My name is Christina Hines. I'm a nurse practitioner. I work for a tribal, I won't say the tribe, but
Indian Health.
Yes,
yep.
Indian
Got
Health.
It.
And when we get our guidance by the infectious disease doctor, who sort of guides all the providers on how to treat COVID, we were given out emails, cannot use hydroxychloroquine. Basically, the next day, the head infectious disease doctor said, we've been seeing a little too much ivermectin prescribed. We need to do our best to prevent this.
Well, my point is, don't get wedded to too many drugs. I did a seminar with Dr. Chetty from South Africa. He said the same thing going on in South Africa. By the way, whatever's going on is worldwide, right? So in Australia in April, they put on the books, they'll put a doctor in jail if he dares prescribe hydroxychloroquine. You get put in jail to prescribe a generic drug that we've been using for 65 years. Something's going on, I'm telling you guys. In France, hydroxychloroquine was over the counter. They made a prescription, then they restricted it. The second largest hydroxychloroquine plant outside of Taipei mysteriously burns down. They were burning hydroxychloroquine across the pharmacies of Africa by some type of military guys at night. They put a doctor in jail in South Africa because she tried to help a patient with ivermectin. Something is going on, you guys, and it's in the minds of people, and it's in the minds of your directors and people at the Indian Health Service and elsewise. What Dr. Chetty taught me is that you can treat this illness in so many ways. So his approach involves no hydroxy, no ivermectin. You time the illness. He uses inhaled budesonide, prednisone. He uses cyproheptadine, montelukast, and he times it with aspirin and anticoagulants, and he treats it without these two drugs. So the idea is there's many different ways to treat the illness, and we're going to have to be creative. It's in the minds of people where they've taken hydroxychloroquine, I think because it's so effective, it has three mechanisms of action, and ivermectin because it's so effective, and they've tried to make them the linchpins. That if we can take away hydroxy and take away ivermectin, somehow force more people into vaccination, and they can't stop us.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Quick question. Senator Ron Johnson came out, and I think you touched on this a little bit tonight, but he came out and said that we do not have approved FDA vaccine, that it was kind of a bait and switch.
Right.
And I wonder if you just clarify that a little bit.
Yeah, Pfizer was not approved. They got a continuation of the emergency use authorization. Comirnaty, which is the BioNTech vaccine, did get conditional approval, but that's not commercialized yet. So the Pfizer vaccine is as it is. It's the same dose. It hasn't been changed, and it's not FDA approved. That became a false talking point. Yeah, I think it's one of the reasons why the vaccine director resigned 7 days later. They knew it was wrong. And it got to the president of the United States when told America that Pfizer was approved when it wasn't. And all it did was trigger a bunch of mandates, which were ill-advised.
You quoted 15,000 on the bears. Is it possible that all the deaths haven't actually been recorded on the bears?
Yes, so there's an underreporting And we've looked at this very carefully. There's another way to figure out who's died. If you look at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they know who's gotten the vaccine and they know who's died. So using those, the underreporting calculus is about 5. Previous Harvard study showed it could be 100 to 10 underreporting, but the factor is 5, because when someone dies of the vaccine, by the way, the VAERS reports, 80% of the time it's a doctor or nurse who makes the entry, and the CDC verifies it. The CDC verifies every death. I've reported one. They verify every death. So what you see, 13,000 is real, but there is a whistleblower lawsuit from CMS, somebody who works with CMS data, working with an attorney, Attorney Tom Rentz, basically since the number back in June was probably 45,000, it could be closer. 45,000 people died. That's bigger than a war.
Second question. The shot that you get, does Moderna or Pfizer put all the ingredients on the label?
No, the package insert is blank right now. And so we have descriptions. Now, we have descriptions in the investigational brochure. So we know about lipid 10 nanoparticles. We know about the messenger RNA. And then there's great speculation on other things. But we simply don't know because it hasn't been disclosed to America.
Why? Is that normal? Would a normal vaccine have the ingredients? Or
yes. So a fully approved vaccine, which none of them became approved, a fully approved vaccine would have to disclose in the package insert what the ingredients are. So, I think you would ask for the complete and total freedom for your doctor to prescribe any and all medications that your doctor thinks that you need without any fear of threat of medical licensure or whatever. Your doctor thinks you need prednisone, let them get some prednisone. Help. Let's help each other. And the second thing, if you could just press your legislators to drop the vaccine mandates. You know, if the vaccine is elective and people want to take it, fine, what have you. But mandates are things that have already, months ago, were determined to be illegal. We can't allow our governments to enforce illegalities on us. And so from the very beginning, there was no place for vaccine mandates. And to shut them off, already you hear about people losing their jobs. And you gotta stop it. Yes.
I am seeing the medications that are working against COVID are antiparasitical. Mm-hmm. Hydroxychloroquine, mm-hmm. ivermectin. It seems like this is more of a parasite than a virus.
Well, just let me make the observation that hydroxychloroquine works against malaria, right? So the idea is the virus gets inside of the cell. These drugs work inside the cell, and so does doxycycline and azithromycin, and they work to just impair the virus's ability to set up shop. So it's not inconceivable that this would actually make an impact. It makes sense. And for hydroxy and ivermectin, it's been worked out. There's like 3 different ways they fight SARS-CoV-2 from a basic science perspective.
I feel like I just was a witness to history tonight. When the people of God, I feel like, take our country back, because I think that's what's going to happen. This is, you kind of danced around it, but this is about good and evil. What came to mind when you were speaking is a quote from C.S. Lewis from the Screwtape Letters. And it's when he's speaking to Wormwood, he says at one point, "The fact that devils are predominantly comic figures in the modern imagination will help you. If any faint suspicion of your existence begins to arise in his mind, suggest to him a picture of something in red tights and persuade him that since he cannot believe in that, he therefore cannot believe in you." And that's just aside, but the other just question I had, and just more open-ended,
Well, let me just respond to that for a second. You know, I intentionally didn't spell out what I think is going on because I want you to figure it out, and I think you have figured it out. And that's a very important process, because when someone figures it out for you, that's called demagoguery. You don't want that. You want everybody to figure it out for themselves. If they figure it out as you have, and you've gone to C.S. Lewis or you've gone to Scripture, you've got it. You've got it. You realize we're living in a very special time.
And then the main question I have is around how you were so demonized for months around, you were in the lead up to the vaccine. and the entire time is here being demonized. And I mean, I'll be honest, I'm a pretty cynical person. Like, I kind of saw where this is going. And all I could think about is they're demonizing you on purpose. They're demonizing all these others on purpose. And then I go to later find out that an EUA can only be given if there are no alternatives. If men like you and all the other courageous people in this country are silenced and demonized and thrown to this curb and taken completely out of the public discourse so they can get an EUA on these drugs in the absence of any alternatives.
It may not be so much the EUA mechanism, it's just, could you actually get the population to accept a vaccine at all costs? And a method of doing that may be actually to try to suppress early treatment, to suppress any hope of treatment, make people think that the only thing they can do is take the vaccine. And there are people who think that. There's family members who think, listen, there are doctors who think that. The only thing you can do is take the vaccine. I don't think the EUA mechanism is a strong argument for the following reasons. The Regeneron and originally the Lilly monoclonal antibodies, they were EUA approved before the vaccine. So in a sense, we already had a treatment for COVID-19 that would have been in that space. But a treatment of COVID-19 is a different indication than the prevention of COVID-19, which would have been a vaccine. And so if you looked at hydroxy or ivermectin or the other drugs, I don't think it's the competitive landscape, because the EUA is not a solid regulatory mechanism. It's actually never been used before COVID-19. So I don't think they were dancing around the illegalities. I think actually this was a mass psychological operation that took place. But good points, and thanks for C.S. Lewis.
So I'm a retail pharmacist, and whenever this all started, the company that I worked for, one of the bigger chains, they had said that they came out with a notice and said that we can't dispense hydroxychloroquine without a diagnosis code. I was totally against that, and so were many of the other people that I work with.
But 2 years ago, 2 years ago, could you dispense it without a diagnosis code?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, and then I left that company and I went to this other one. So now a lot of my colleagues that are also pharmacists with the same company are saying that we can't dispense ivermectin without a diagnosis code. I know you're not a lawyer, but like, is there anything that I should know from my standpoint? I mean, as a physician, you write a prescription. Unless there is an error in that prescription as far as dosing goes, I don't feel like it's my call to say how you can treat your patient.
Yeah, I just think that I've heard about these stories all over. Americans know it. The question is, what's going on upstream? Who gave that order and why? Right? That's what you want to know. Who along your chain actually now wants to see a diagnosis code for COVID-19? What prompted them to do that? What's different now than 2 years ago? Right? So if I used hydroxychloroquine for dry eyes, which I can, or alopecia, which I can, I can use hydroxy for a lot of stuff. I used it for pyoderma gangrenosum the other day. I can use it for rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, malaria. You know, I can use it for a lot of things without giving you the diagnosis code. So I think the context is COVID, that they don't want somebody sick with COVID to get COVID-19, or if they do, they want a diagnosis code. So what if the doctor put a COVID-19 diagnosis code? Are you allowed to dispense it?
No.
That's what they want. So the end goal is they want to block a sick COVID patient from getting hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
Yeah. I just thought it was interesting.
But that's the goal. But the question is, why would they want a sick patient to not get a drug that the doctor thinks could help them?
Because they say that it's not FDA approved for treatment. But neither was the vaccine. Like, it was.
But hydroxy is not FDA approved for alopecia. It's not approved for Sickle syndrome.
True.
So the idea is the FDA tells us to use drugs off label. I gave you the slide on that.
Yeah.
That's perfectly
so
legal.
So basically, I should find out where that's coming from, maybe.
Find out where it's coming from, because we have to get to the root of this. Somebody doesn't want sick patients with COVID to get treatment. You know, by the way, look at monoclonal antibodies. We have 100 million purchase doses, 500, back in November, 500 million doses, on this negotiated order, and suddenly now there's hide and go seek with the monoclonal antibodies. Is it the same people who don't want monoclonal antibodies to be treated? Well, let me ask you this much, since you're a pharmacist, I want to know. How about if I prescribe prednisone? Do you need the diagnosis code?
No.
How about azithromycin?
No.
Doxy?
Nope.
Colchicine?
Nope.
How about Xarelto?
Nope.
Okay.
Just hydroxychloroquine.
So just those two. That's the reason why I'm telling you, people have given up on them. They're going to still treat COVID-19.
And yeah, the we have to give the Pfizer vaccine where I work, and it's still the original label. It's still the same vaccine that that was distributed to us under the EAU. But I called Pfizer the other day, and they said that it's still there are no legal differences, but I think there are.
Okay, I have to ask you a question, so you're a pharmacist. One of my patients the other day told me. Now, they're vaccine aficionados, like they love the idea of vaccines, husband and wife, that they took Pfizer back in January, December, and they kind of wanted a booster. So they went into CVS or Walgreens even before boosters were approved for immunocompromised, and they asked for a booster, and they got it. Is that true?
Yep.
How could a pharmacist give a booster if it's not even EUA approved to do that?
And whenever it was approved, for just the immunocompromised, we were not even, like, several of us got in trouble for talking to the patient to make sure, because if you're not immunocompromised, I don't want to risk it.
Oh, so it was wide open for you to give extra boosters where they're not indicated, but and it was not, so you could give hydroxychloroquine if it...
Yep.
Now, is that as clear as you can get in terms of this?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Right?